in April. It faced immediate criticism as kind of an Orwellian ministry of truth. After kind of facing this criticism from both left and right, Biden shuttered this board in August. But the documents that we report on show that the efforts to police social media live on under CISA, which is a multi-billion dollar agency that meets monthly with the private sector. They were meeting regularly.
Let me ask you something, because we just have 20 seconds, Lee. Do you see CISA in the United States further emboldening autocratic regimes like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, to force social media companies to repress their citizens?
Look, every society faces disinformation campaigns, false information on social media. What we're seeing in closed societies, in autocratic societies, this is an effort to suppress freedom of speech, to suppress social media, to suppress the press. And in open societies, we should be countering it with more speech, with better speech. The question is, as we see across the globe, this kind of crisis of disinformation, will the U.S. take a more open society
We're
approach
gonna have to leave
or
it there.
Adopt the strategies of
we'll
more closed autocratic regimes?
We'll link to your piece, Lee, on Truth Cops. That does it for our show.
Thank
Check
you for
out
having
our
me.
Election night coverage. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
A date which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KBOO on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KBOO hosts. That's KBOO's live midterm election coverage, starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council votes to criminalize homelessness and build mass encampments. New CDC data shows a worrying uptick in alcohol-related deaths, and the story of one foundation helping local families in need celebrate Christmas. Good evening, this is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 4th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Portland City Council voted to approve an unfunded plan to criminalize unsheltered homelessness. It's part of a plan introduced 2 weeks ago by Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and Commissioner Dan Ryan. It's been criticized for moving too quickly with too few details, limited public input, and having no dollars to back it up. The council passed five resolutions as a package on Thursday. It will create designated mass camping sites for houseless people in unidentified locations. Now there's five planned across the city to house 250 people each. There isn't funding set aside for this, but the proposal says once funding is secured, the mass encampments would open within 18 months. Once those camps are open, the city would start enforcing a ban on camping in public spaces. If unhoused folks won't vacate public property, they can be arrested. The proposal does ask for money and support from the district attorney's office to create a diversion court to help keep homeless people out of jail. The council also set a goal of building 20,000 units of affordable housing by 2033 and creating more jobs for unhoused Portlanders. The proposals also compel the city to ask the state, the county, and metro for money to fund their plan. What could this cost? Well, the City Budget Office estimates a nearly $7 million price tag each year to operate the camps, and $10 billion are needed for the housing the city wants to build. Not all of the resolutions passed unanimously. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty voted against the criminalization measure and the mass camps, saying, quote, "It's cruel and inhumane." Thursday morning, the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon urged the council to delay their vote, saying that these resolutions could be unconstitutional and that their plan needed more community feedback. At public hearings last week, Commissioner Dan Ryan did not allow for an organic mix of public feedback in the open comment section, instead setting aside the first hour for business lobbyists and realtors to speak first. At a public forum that Street Roots held with Wheeler and Ryan on Wednesday, houseless Portlanders voiced their concerns with the plan. Some questioned how the city planned to keep people safe in mass camps, voicing fears of being vulnerable and unsafe in that environment. The city plan doesn't have details about safety in camps. Commissioners Ryan, Maps, and Rubio voted for the plan, along with Mayor Wheeler. They stressed that their votes were based on a need for urgency on the issue. The expanded child tax credit implemented by Congress last year pulled millions of kids out of poverty by paying their parents a few hundred dollars a month. Nearly a year after it expired, there are calls to reinstate it. Eric Tegedoff has more in Washington.
The expanded child tax credit lifted 3.7 million kids out of poverty in the U.S., including many in Washington. The tax credit expired last year, but has led to a call to reinstate it to help families pay for basic needs. When the program lapsed, child poverty increased by more than 40%. Megan Peary, a parent ambassador with Head Start in Eastern Washington, has four children adopted from foster care. She bought a house just before the pandemic, was then laid off, and due to an administrative mix-up, didn't get unemployment for 3 months. Peary says the tax credit saved her.
Without that child tax credit, we probably would be homeless. We probably would have lost our house. I can't even think about that, but what I can think about is the fact that as a community advocate and as someone invested in our families, we have to continue to do things like this and make sure they happen.
The expanded child tax credit provided monthly payments of $300 to $360 per child to families, depending on the child's age. According to a recent survey, food insecurity for families in Washington state has increased nearly 58% from last year when the tax credit was in place. Opponents in Congress say the program contributed to inflation. Indeed, the rising cost of goods because of inflation is hitting families hard. But Peary says reinstating the expanded child tax credit now is crucial to ensure more families can get by.
Food benefits have not increased. A pair of shoes is twice as much. How will families make it?
Peary is convinced the program would benefit future generations.
It's really something that's an investment into our communities and into our kids. It's not a handout. It's something that says, here, we recognize that our country is in this state, that we need to help those that are going to build our country back.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, was attacked last week by an assailant with a hammer searching for her. Democratic candidates for state and federal office in Oregon shared their concerns about political violence in the U.S. earlier this week. I spoke with Republican candidate for Oregon Congressional District Number 1, Chris Mann, to hear his thoughts.
What concerns do you have about political violence in the United States, like the recent attack on Paul Pelosi?
We have had so many incidents, and we can go back to 2017, when Rand Paul had four of his ribs broken. We can go back to the shooting where a Democrat supporter went out and tried to shoot a whole entire baseball field of Republican senators. And it's just continuing to go on and on and on. And with Paul Pelosi, if he's injured, I hope he's okay. But that was a made-up narrative. It's been already proven now that his computer postings were not his. And so we have to really, as a country, which is why I'm running, is stop being so quick to assume that the first narrative that comes out is the correct one. This was a homeless illegal immigrant that lived in a tent with Black Lives Matter flags coming out of his tent. So for somebody to come out like the press did, immediately call him a MAGA supporter, and he had the same kind of stuff on people on January 6th, is obviously pretty humorous once all the facts came out that they were wrong, as usual, with their immediate irresponsible reporting.
And what do you see as the biggest threats to democracy in the U.S. these days?
It's what I've noticed as our campaigning is the fact that no matter who you are and what side you're on, whether you're Republican or Democrat or an independent or Green Party, that people are not open to discussion anymore. And I've been voting for quite a while now, but I've handed a business card to somebody that said, hey, I'm running for congressional district number one. And instead of asking how I feel about the crime or the homelessness, they ask me, what party are you with? And I said, I'm running as a Republican. They immediately either hand me back the card, drop it, or go, I would never vote for a Republican. And that's the biggest threat to our democracy, is people now feel like their life is going to be in jeopardy if they don't vote for a party they registered with. And that really breaks my heart as a veteran of 21 years who fights for people's freedom, that people are no longer willing to open and listen to other people's points of views.
That was Chris Mann, the Republican candidate for Oregon Congressional District No. 1. CNN reported yesterday that the man who assaulted Paul Pelosi is a Canadian citizen who entered the U.S. illegally. Beto O'Rourke rallies the college vote across Texas, and President Biden says Republicans are to blame if student debt relief fails. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Gun violence, the leading cause of death of children and teenagers. So be thinking about your younger brothers and sisters and what they face in these classrooms in El Paso right now.
Texas gubernatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke is energizing college students against gun violence. From El Paso to Dallas, O'Rourke is criticizing Texas Governor Greg Abbott's failure to prevent more school shootings, such as the one in Uvalde. O'Rourke is also encouraging young voters to rally their families for early voting, which ends tomorrow in Texas. Early voters have already cast more than 32 million ballots nationwide.
I've always believed your generation, the 18 to 30-year generation, represents the best educated, most talented, least prejudiced, most generous generation in American history. And I really mean that. It is. That's why I'm so optimistic about the future.
In New Mexico, President Joe Biden promoted Democrats' efforts to cancel student debt for millions of Americans. Nearly 26 million people have already applied at studentaid.gov, but the relief plan has been hampered by lawsuits filed by Republican governors of several states hoping to end debt relief before it begins. In New York, where the race for governor is closer than Democrats ever expected, Hillary Clinton stumped for Governor Kathy Hochul.
She gets the fact that upstate New York really began the Industrial Revolution in America, fell on some hard times, and we have a chance to bring it back if we have Kathy Hochul as the governor working to do.
Clinton was joined by Vice President Kamala Harris at the event, meant to energize women voters to turn out for New York's first female governor. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer predicts Democrats will keep control of the Senate and possibly gain seats in the midterm elections. Recent polls have shown several key Senate races to be too close to call, including in Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, was released from the hospital after surviving a brutal home invasion. Republicans continue to tie the attack to crime across the country. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene told a rally for former President Donald Trump in Iowa that Democrats care more about the border and Ukraine than they do about the U.S. southern border.
Paul Pelosi was brutally attacked by a drugged-out illegal alien that should have been deported, and Paul Pelosi should have been a gun owner and shot his attacker.
Finally, the White House says U.S. embassy officials in Russia met with imprisoned WNBA star Brittany Griner, who was sentenced to 9.5 years in prison for bringing less than a gram of illegal cannabis oil into the country in February. A Russian court rejected Griner's appeal of her sentence last week. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The rate of deaths directly caused by alcohol rose almost 30% in the U.S. during the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to new government data. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention previously noted the overall number of alcohol-related deaths rose in both 2020 and 2021. Now, two reports coming out this week provide more information on which groups have the highest death rates and which states are seeing the worst numbers. More than a dozen kinds of deaths were wholly blamed on drinking, Examples include alcohol-caused liver or pancreatic failure, alcohol poisoning, and withdrawal. There were more than 52,000 such deaths last year, up from 39,000 in 2019. The rate of such deaths had already been increasing in the 20 years before the pandemic, but by only 7% or less each year. In 2020, they rose 26%. That's the highest rate recorded in at least 40 years. Alcohol-caused deaths are 2.5 times more common in men than they are in women, but they rose for both in 2020. The rate is highest in people 55 to 64, but it also rose significantly for certain other groups, including a 42% rise in women aged 35 to 44. The second report looked at other types of deaths that could be linked to drinking, such as motor vehicle accidents, suicides, falls, and cancers. Most of those deaths are coming from drinking too much over a long period of time, though a significant fraction arise from causes tied to acute intoxication. The study found that as many as 1 in 8 deaths in U.S. adults aged 20 to 64 were alcohol-related. Excessive drinking is associated with chronic illnesses such as liver cancer, high blood pressure, strokes, and heart disease. And alcohol is a factor in as many as 1/3 of serious falls among the elderly. Even before the pandemic, U.S. alcohol consumption was trending up. But deaths may have increased since the COVID-19 pandemic began for several reasons, including the possibility that people with alcohol-related illnesses may have had more trouble getting medical care. The research points to the need to look at steps to reduce alcohol consumption, including increasing alcohol taxes and enacting limits on where people can buy beer, wine, and liquor. Marissa Esser leads the CDC's alcohol program. Esser said, quote, "Alcohol is often overlooked as a public health problem, but it is a leading preventable cause of death," end quote. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Boom Goddess Radio, then at 7, Civic Cypher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with high winds and a low of 45. There's a high wind advisory for the Portland metro area and the Willamette Valley until midday Saturday. Residents could lose power as a result of this. Tomorrow's weather will continue to be rainy with a high of 57 degrees. Today in history, in 1916, American broadcast journalist and anchor Walter Cronkite was born. He reported from the late 1930s to 1981 and was the only non-NASA recipient of the Ambassador of Exploration Award. The quote of the day is from Cronkite, who said, quote, "Journalism is what we need to make democracy work." The holiday season is fast approaching, and the Christmas Family Adoption Foundation helps connect families in need to people in the Portland, Salem, and Vancouver area who give donations for gifts for Christmas. This weekend is their 20th anniversary gala. We spoke with Mercedes Gutierrez of the Christmas Family Adoption Foundation to learn more.
The Christmas Family Adoption Foundation is started in 2002 by Mike Burright, who was a realtor, and he listed a home that was in foreclosure. The owners were a young couple with two small children who were basically going to lose everything. In November, Mike was sitting on their couch with a little boy on his lap, and the mother shared with him that the hardest thing was knowing that she would have nothing to give to her children on Christmas. Mike got deeply touched, so he took pictures of the children and put together a wish list for all the family. He made a flyer and mailed it to all of his clients, family, and friends, asking them to help him give the family a needed Christmas miracle. On Christmas morning, it took 3 vehicles to deliver the gifts, including a Christmas dinner. From those humble beginnings, the Christmas Family Adoption Foundation, CFAF, was born. CFAF is a nonprofit organization that today has helped thousands of families in the Portland, Salem, and Vancouver metro areas. Our families are all nominated by caseworkers or school counselors and are adopted by our angels who come from all over to give these families the ability to celebrate Christmas and know that they are loved. Last year, we were able to adopt 1,070 families, and in our first 19 years, we have adopted 6,937 families. I am so excited because This year, we are celebrating 20 years of serving the community and bringing lots of smiles and joy to the families. Everyone from the board, including the president of the foundation, are non-paid volunteers. We do this work because we love to serve our communities. You can find more information at ChristmasFamilyAdoption.com. Thank you so much.
The Coeur d'Alene Tribe receives grant money to help restore drought-stricken wetlands. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Coeur d'Alene Tribe has received grant money to help restore wetlands on the reservation that are being impacted by drought conditions. Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson reports.
In recent years, low precipitation has increased the dry conditions on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation. Tribal Fisheries Manager Angelo Vitale has worked for the tribe for 27 years.
And I've seen these small streams go dry in the summertime, some of them for the first time probably in recorded history. And these are the same streams that support spawning for important species like cutthroat trout and red band trout.
Now the tribe is receiving a $500,000 grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to improve conditions of wetlands that have been drying up. The wetlands can mitigate the impacts of drought by absorbing and retaining excess water during wet periods and then returning it to the water table when it's dry. Six projects aim to improve conditions in sections of Hangman, Lake, and Benoit Creeks. Vitale says the work will focus on restoring some of the natural character of streams disrupted for years by human interventions.
And in a place like that, we're plugging all of the drainage ditches, returning the stream to its historical location in the valley bottom, and that's going to help kind of re-wet this valley bottom sponge and recreate that stored reservoir of water.
Work will also be done to preserve existing beaver dams or replicate them with wood and brush. Besides ensuring fish will have more available water, the restored wetlands will provide habitat for migrating waterfowl and help plants considered important to the tribal culture, like water potato, camas, cottonwood, and aspen, thrive. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
Tribal leaders discussed the impacts of climate change at the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention Thursday in Sacramento, California. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, tribal communities located in coastal areas say their communities are going underwater.
Tribal nations on the West Coast are being affected by climate change in regard to coastal erosion. The Shoalwater Bay Tribe in Washington has seen their lands eroded by rising waters. Charlene Nelson, tribal chairwoman, says their decision to move the tribe is in the best interest of the people.
I think they will like it. I think they will be able to have more say in what's being built. I think some of them could probably build their own houses if they, you know, had the if, you know, we had the land prepared, the road and all that kind of stuff. I think it can be kind of an exciting thing, and it will be for them and for anybody who comes after them, because that's what we need to think about, I think, about now. We want our tribe to survive. All tribes are survivors, and we want our tribe to survive.
Mike Williams, Yupik Nation Unity in Alaska, explains how warmer temperatures affected his people.
Fall time is when we see a lot, and we just had a recent Mohawk disaster impact, and we prepared for it, and I think we've seen like 30 yards of erosion during that recent storm.
Work is being done in the federal government to streamline applying for aid in these natural disasters for tribes, which can't come fast enough. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In the final days before the midterm election, candidates in battleground states are making last-minute pitches to voters. Recent polling in rural areas shows voters are most concerned about economic issues like inflation and aren't optimistic things will get better. Mike Moen has the details on the poll's results.
Leading up to next week's election,
New polling shows rural voters in Wisconsin and other states are worried about the present and pessimistic about the future. The poll, commissioned by the Daily Yonder, touches mainly on economic issues and found 3/4 of respondents think the U.S. economy isn't working for them. Roughly the same amount believe things will be worse for future generations. The Daily Yonder's Tim Merrima says it's eye-opening that rural voters are so worried about their financial situation. But he adds factors such as higher gas prices can be a major drag on budgets in smaller communities.
They have to travel farther for services and work, so that's not too surprising. If gas prices are high, rural places feel it especially hard.
Some 59% of respondents said they intend to vote for Republicans in congressional races. But Merrima says these are long-standing issues that stretch beyond the current election. He notes rural areas have dealt with job loss and population declines for some time, and no matter which party gains power, it will have to address structural economic issues in rural America. The polling firm notes that while these voters are likely to maintain their support for Republican candidates, respondents had dim views of wealthy corporations and CEOs. Merrima says that could give Democrats a better chance to deliver a populist message to rural voters.
There's an opportunity there for candidates to talk about those economic issues and what Democrats might do differently than Republicans.
Social issues, including abortion, fail to register as much as economic concerns. The poll surveyed 400 likely rural voters in 11 battleground states. In addition to Wisconsin, Michigan and Missouri were the other Midwestern states included in the poll. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
Research shows that less than a tenth of plastic waste has been recycled, and plastics pollution is a problem that's expected to grow exponentially in the coming decades. As Eric Tegedoff reports, Washington state lawmakers could pass legislation in their next session to curb plastic waste.
Plastic waste is a growing problem across the globe, and it's not just an issue for landfills. Policymakers in Washington state are aiming to find solutions to this pollution. Recent research has found that by 2050, plastic waste will be 4 times larger than it is now. In the 2022 session, lawmakers in Olympia introduced, but didn't pass, the Renew Act, which would have created more responsibility for plastic packaging producers once a product reached the end of its life. Nora Nickum with the Seattle Aquarium says there will be another effort to pass this policy next session.
They can do a lot to design things that use less material and that use materials that are much more easily recycled or composted. They can also work to design packaging that is reusable so that it doesn't end up in the waste stream at all.
Nickum notes that every step of the plastics production process produces carbon pollution. 4 states have passed laws mandating higher responsibilities for plastics manufacturers, including California and Oregon. A coalition of groups known as Plastic Free Washington will be pushing for this policy in the 2023 session. Plastics producers and recyclers say this policy won't be useful if it creates too many onerous regulations on their industries. Plastic waste is a problem globally, and that also means in Washington's own backyard. It poses a threat before it breaks down, potentially being ingested by animals, and also takes a long time to degrade. The Seattle Aquarium's Clean Seas research team studies microplastics in Elliott Bay and how well the aquarium's filters work to sift out these tiny particles. Amy Olson with the team says research has found microplastics are ubiquitous in the environment.
From the air to the oceans to lakes and streams to the soil. And there's a lot of research going on now to see whether or not a lot of the chemicals that we use in plastic leach out of these microparticles into animals that ingest them.
Nickum says the legislation would provide incentives for producers to make more sustainable products, and also that it's an outcome-based policy.
Producers are best able to innovate and figure out the most efficient and cost-effective way to meet those targets, so that design is really important to allow the industry to play the role that they're well-suited to play.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Red Cross says they need disaster relief volunteers more than ever. Volunteers set up shelters, arrange hot meals, and provide psychological first aid. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. After hurricanes, wildfires, and other disasters, people need help. Perhaps a place to sleep, a meal, emotional support, or help navigating the disaster recovery process. and Stephanie Fox of the American Red Cross says trained volunteers can provide much of that critical assistance.
Our volunteers help shelter, feed, distribute supplies, provide comfort and care of mental health and spiritual nature. They conduct damage assessment. They coordinate casework.
To train their volunteers, the Red Cross runs free workshops. They cover topics such as food safety, shelter management, and psychological first aid.
That advanced training and that advanced engagement really allows us to best utilize folks to make sure we have those positions filled.
Fox says climate change is increasing the frequency of extreme weather disasters. In 2020 and 2021, the Red Cross averaged a new major disaster response every 10 days.
That's with Red Cross volunteers continuously on the ground, setting up shelters, arranging hot meals, and sheltering thousands of people who had no other place to go.
So she says the need for disaster relief volunteers is greater than ever. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 4th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Charles Chambry. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Eric Tegedoff, Mike Moen, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.